Kane is in the building.
Greetings, 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 fine people, greetings. Hope all is well in your world. I am Bobby Stamps. This is the Stamp of Approval podcast. This is episode 2 of hopefully many, the second one. I would like to thank you for joining me today. Thank you for taking your time and choosing to listen to me. I realize you have a lot of choices out there on podcasts or radio or satellite radio, and I would like to let you know that I thoroughly appreciate you choosing me and supporting this podcast. Also want to thank B-Hyphen. B-Hyphen is a Hyphen Podcast Group, the distributor of the podcast. He is also basically the nuts and bolts behind this thing. We could not make it go without him. He puts it together. He posts it. He puts, you know, makes sure everything sounds right and gets it distributed to the various platforms that you're able to hear it. So big shout out to B-Hyphen. Big shout out to, and a big thank you to Hyphen Podcast Group. I want to encourage you as well. There are a lot of podcasts over there at Hyphen Podcast Group, a lot of very talented podcasters, I guess you could call it. So check those guys out. See if there's anything else over there that is interesting to you and that you would like to consistently listen to and consistently support. So big thank you to B-Hyphen. Wow, well, college football weekend 4 is now in the books. The marquee game on the schedule, as we talked about last week, was Georgia-Notre Dame. That game did not disappoint. I was lucky enough to be in the stadium that night and in Athens that day tailgating, and just a fabulous day all around. In Athens, the atmosphere was more, I'm not going to say it was as electric or was it was more electric than I have ever seen anywhere. People, Athenians, Georgians, the Dog Nation, we've had this game circled for a long time. It's not very frequently that a team, the caliber of Notre Dame, comes to Athens to play, so it was a big deal. The fact that Notre Dame was a top 10 team and undefeated, Georgia was obviously undefeated, that made the stakes a little higher. That just ramped up the excitement that much more. And the game did not disappoint. It was a very hard-fought game, as we said it would be last week, right? You remember we said, hey, now let's go back and revisit. Did Notre Dame have pride? Yeah, they did. Did Notre Dame have good coaching? Yeah, they did. In my opinion, they had better coaching than we did that game. Brian Kelly and crew outcoached Kirby and crew. Not a slap at Kirby, it's just a giving credit to Brian Kelly, okay? The fact is Georgia just had more athletes. There's a saying in coaching, it's not about the X's and the O's, it's about the Jimmies and the Joes. And in that particular game, Georgia just had more and better Jimmies than Notre Dame did Joes, and was able to pull out, to squeak out a much closer win than it should have been. As we talked about last week, we thought that Georgia would be able to come into that game and wear down the Irish using their depth and their athleticism and pull away late. And that is pretty much the script that was followed until, for some reason, Kirby Smart thought that it would be the wise thing to do to slow the ball down when, as soon as the Irish was getting tired, they were about to break, they were faking the injuries on the field, and Kirby, he started running the stall game. He allowed Notre Dame to catch their breath. He allowed them to get back focused. And for whatever reason, he faked the injuries for the Irish, quite frankly. They didn't have to fake injuries anymore once Georgia slowed down. Really questionable move, in my opinion, by him. It will be interesting to see moving forward if he continues to try to stall once he gets a small lead, or if he keeps his foot on the gas and puts the game away like a talented team should do. Let's move around, get into a few more of the contests. Auburn going down to Texas A&M was a big game. Probably, obviously, the next biggest game in the SEC. And as we thought, Auburn won the game pretty handily. And why did they win the game pretty handily? Well, they have a decided advantage on both lines of scrimmage. The lines of scrimmage win football games, guys. A lot of people, hello Atlanta Falcons, think that you can have a lot of shiny toys at your skill positions and you can get away with having a subpar line of scrimmage. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't. It's not going to work. You have to have solid lines of scrimmage. Auburn does. They have question marks at their skill positions. They have a true freshman quarterback, Bo Nix, that, and you can't blame him. He's not ready for prime time yet. Credit Gus Malzahn for putting Bo in very easy situations for him to manage the game and manage the team to a win. He actually brought in Joey Gatewood, the backup quarterback who was in the quarterback battle with Bo Nix. And Joey Gatewood has a different skill set. He's a much bigger guy. He's more of an established runner. So Gus Malzahn was able to put him in the game to throw off the Aggie defense and to bring something else to that Auburn offensive attack. And credit to Gus Malzahn, credit Auburn. They went on the road. They went to Kyle Field, 100,000 plus. It was hot, and they were able to come away with a pretty dominating win. That game was not as close as the score appeared. I think Auburn's defense held the Aggie rushing attack to around 50 yards. And Kellen Mond was able to get a lot of yards through the air, but a lot of that was junk time when the game was already decided. So credit to Auburn. They appear to be possibly for real. It remains to be seen how far Bo Nix can take them his first year on campus. But, you know, hey, they're undefeated. Men lie, women lie, numbers don't. Auburn's undefeated, guys. So we'll see how far they can go. And as we thought with Texas A&M, they're just going to have problems matching up with the big boys in the SEC on the lines of scrimmage, because that's just there's not a lot of big linemen and as many as you need for Texas A&M to consistently challenge. They may have a few years where they catch lightning in a bottle and have some guys develop. And, you know, that one year they had Jake Matthews and they had another Luke Jokel, two first-round offensive tackles. I don't know that will happen much more. USC, we talked about USC hosting Utah. It looked as if USC was spiraling, and it looked as if Clay Helton's job was in jeopardy, which I think it still is. Utah came in, and I think this game was just primed for a USC win. USC does have those athletes. They may not be as well coached, but USC has a lot of fast, quick-twitch athletes on the field, and Utah does not. And it showed, and USC was able to win that game and get a big win and at least pump a little life into Clay Helton's coaching career. We'll see if he can maintain that. I'll tell you who needs life in his coaching career, if it's not over already, and that's Jim Harbaugh at Michigan. How does Jim Harbaugh at Michigan flop as much as he does? He's 0-7 in games at Michigan where he is an underdog. Michigan recruited very well before Jim Harbaugh got there. They had athletes when he got there. Michigan has continued to recruit very well under Jim Harbaugh. How are you laying an egg that much, Jim Harbaugh? If I'm a Michigan booster, if I'm one of those guys that write those checks to the athletic department for the football program to support Jim Harbaugh, I'm really asking a lot of tough questions right now. I don't know that, well, in my opinion, I do know Jim Harbaugh is not the guy to lead that team. And it's pretty hard to imagine. Let's think back just a few years. I think it was after the 13 season. Jim Harbaugh led the San Francisco 49ers with quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Yes, he of the guy that hasn't played in the NFL for a few years. Some may debate the reason he's not in the NFL, but the fact is, guys, he's not physically good enough to be a starting quarterback. I know some of you don't want to hear it, but that is the fact. Those owners are all about winning, winning, winning. And if they thought they could win football, they would sign Colin Kaepernick in a minute. Okay, but That's not the topic at this point. We're talking Jim Harbaugh, Michigan. How did Jim Harbaugh lead the 49ers to within, I think it was, what, 5 yards of a Super Bowl win? And now he can't beat anybody at Michigan unless he is a decided favorite with much better talent. Pro tip, guys, I think a group of kids could coach Michigan over an inferior team, somebody like an Indiana. Right? So how Jim Harbaugh's not able to show well against an Ohio State, against a even Wisconsin. I'll guarantee you Michigan has more players. It'd be interesting to see. Let's look. Michigan has more players on this team, I'll be willing to wager you, that make NFL rosters than Wisconsin does. So that means that Paul Christ and crew at Wisconsin flat out whipped Jim Harbaugh and his coaches behinds last Saturday. I think Jim Harbaugh's time at Michigan is numbered. I just don't see. I think his spill is over. Similar to Dan Quinn in Atlanta, we will get to that later on. Those guys are very similar to me, and we'll get to that later on. So good weekend of college football. Good weekend coming up. I think there was a lot of things were made a little more clear. Clemson, Alabama, the top two dogs in the country, had easy patsy wins. Clemson beat Charlotte as expected. Got the starters out of there quickly. Trevor Lawrence, I think, only threw nine passes all game. ATN only ran nine times, and then they got the starters out and got the backups in. One, to get the backups valuable playing time and valuable game experience for when they have to play meaningful snaps later in the season in the event of an injury. Got Chase Bryce into the game, who's played meaningful snaps before at quarterback for Clemson, and they cruised over Charlotte, as they should have. Alabama, same situation. Cruised over Southern Miss, as they should have. Credit to that young Alabama defense that we talked about last week. Played well. They fought. I still think they have major problems. A win over Southern Miss doesn't show me anything as far as, you know, you being able to stop an SEC opponent with real players at skill positions, and that they will exploit that weakness at linebacker for Alabama and the depth on the defensive line. We'll see how that ends up playing out. I don't want to get too unpleasant here, but, you know, we do need to talk about USC. South Carolina. I know people from South Carolina like to refer to them as USC. Everyone else in the Southeast likes to refer to them as USC Junior, but that's what we do. We kind of take backhanded slaps at each other down here. Had a tough loss to Missouri. South Carolina, I don't know what else they can really do. I don't know that Will Muschamp is doing I don't think Will Muschamp is doing a poor job. Steve Spurrier left the cupboard quite bare, but due to his just refusal to recruit. Will has been there. He's getting his players in, but it's just hard in South Carolina to recruit consistently. One, you have Clemson, the hottest program in the country, you know, in your state. Two, you've had teams like Georgia and Alabama and Auburn and Florida consistently coming over into South Carolina and getting players. So it's and three, there's just not the number of quality Division I SEC type football players in South Carolina for you to be sharing them with everybody else. Steve Spurrier, the years that he had Gilmore, Stephon Gilmore, Marcus Lattimore, and Jadeveon Clowney, 3 years in a row he got the number one player from South Carolina, and they played up to their ranking. And South Carolina was able to climb the national stage and compete for an SEC championship. There were times late in the year where South Carolina was in the national championship debate. They ended up falling short due to their overall depth, but they were there. And I think that's the ceiling for South Carolina, but I think more of an adequate description of what South Carolina is would be, they're going to be a middle of the road, 8-4-ish, 9-3-ish team, just based on their limitations recruiting against all these big guys right now. Will Muschamp is doing an okay job. You know, Bentley going out did not help them at all. They're going into battle with a true freshman quarterback. Helsinki, I think his name is, from Washington. And it's just going to be a tough road to hoe for South Carolina. Tough loss to Missouri, as we mentioned. The schedule doesn't get a lot easier for them. They'll play Tennessee at some point in time, and that'll be, you know, if you lose that game, then you may not win a game. We'll see how Vandy ends up playing out, but a lot to work on over there in Columbia. If you're a Gamecock fan, you just got to batten down the hatches and get ready. It's going to be a long haul. Tennessee, I mentioned. You know, the word dumpster fire is very overused in sports talk, I guess you could say, if that's what we're doing now. So I'm not going to say Tennessee is a dumpster fire. They're a lot worse than that. And I don't understand what Tennessee fans expected when they hired, or when that whole mess happened where Fulmer, you know, he muscles himself back into the equation. You know, they interview numerous coaches. I mean, they throw lines out there to you know, John Gruden, allegedly, just and Peyton Manning. I mean, come on, guys. And end up settling on Jeremy Pruitt. And I do say settled on, because, yes, he was at my count, he was about the 13th choice at coach for Tennessee. May end up being a good coach. At this point, it looks doubtful. But the Tennessee faithful thought that they had hired Kirby Smart Jr. Or Kirby, you know, the second coming of Kirby. He was the Alabama guy. And to hear them tell it, he was better than Kirby. That is not the case, obviously. Many coaches get a jump in the second season. And Tennessee seems to have taken a jump, you know, the other way. Okay. I don't understand. If Tennessee fans had looked at what was going on with the coaching hires, that should have rang some alarm bells for you, because he hires two guys at Georgia. He actually hired Kevin Scherer. Kevin Scherer, by all accounts, was still wanted by Kirby in Athens. He was offered the defensive coordinator position, so he took it. Jeremy Pruitt and he were close. It was a step up in his career to a coordinator from a position coach. So Kevin Scherer took the job, and again, by all accounts, Kevin Scherer is a quality coach. I cannot say the same for Jim Chaney. I absolutely cannot say the same for Tracy Rocker. Tennessee faithful got on the message boards and said that Jeremy Pruitt had stolen Georgia's coach, Georgia's offensive coordinator, Jim Chaney. Guys, Jim Chaney was out at Georgia this year. Kirby does things the right way. Jim Chaney was respected in the business. Kirby had no reason to publicly embarrass Jim Chaney, so he allowed him to move on to Tennessee as a mutual parting of ways. Now let's go back and look. James Coley, current offensive coordinator at UGA, was offered the offensive coordinator position at Texas A&M. Before the 18 season, following the 17 season. He was offered the offensive coordinator position plus $1 million per year salary to go to Texas and Texas A&M and coach. If you don't know, Texas A&M, Texas, the state of Texas, has a ton. They have multiple tons and more tons of money than anybody else around here. Would have been a great fit, would have been a great opportunity for James Coley to take that job. He turned that job down, presumably to return to Georgia as the quarterback's coach, and I think about $400,000 to $500,000 a year salary. Why did he do that? Kirby told him that he would be the offensive coordinator when Chaney left. Chaney would be leaving very soon. You don't turn down $500,000. You don't turn down doubling your salary and an advancement in position unless you know that you have some assurances that it will be made right very soon. If Pruitt had looked at Georgia's offensive production, he would have seen that Jim Chaney limited the Georgia offense as opposed to advanced it, and that Pruitt could probably have a lot better choices out there as a coordinator, but in his mind, he was stealing something from Georgia, and he was making the Volunteer faithful very happy by doing so, and that has came back definitely to bite him and proved to be the wrong move there. So let's get this Florida State thing. I know we have some Florida State guys out there, Florida State fans. They picked up a win over Louisville this last week, but I don't know what, you know, a win over Louisville means what now. Who knows? This is the same Louisville team that got their coach fired last year. So, you know, take this with a grain of salt. But Florida State, the Willie Taggart thing is a disaster. I had a prominent Florida State alum, ex-player, ex-longtime NFL guy tell me, and I'm not going to say his name because it was told to me in confidence and in a friendly, casual conversation, not for public consumption. So, but I was told that he was part of a committee of ex-players that was part of the hiring process at Florida State. And that they interviewed Willie Taggart, and their recommendation was that he was not prepared, he was not qualified, he could not do the job. Someone at Florida State decided otherwise and hired him, and now they have just a mess on their hands. I don't know what it will end up. They're playing in the ACC. There will be a lot of easy wins out there. But, of course, they thought Boise would be an easy win. Florida State, they go up and they lose to Virginia. We'll see how Florida State ends up finishing the year out. But I personally think that the Willie Taggart thing will be over, if not during the season, after the season. And then they'll have to start the coaching search again. I'm not close to that program, but I've just heard whispers that there are problems within the administration, and I've heard coaches say that the most important thing to winning championships is not coaches, is not players, is not alumni and boosters. It's the administration, that you have to have the administration on your side to win, and Florida State does not have that, is what I've been told. So let's get back to, we want to get into a little bit about the game of the week, the Georgia-Notre Dame game. Again, just a fabulous environment. I was in the stadium, the most electric atmosphere that I've ever been a part of. And I'm really blessed, I'm lucky and fortunate to have been able to travel to a lot of different stadiums around the country and see big games, both college and professional. I've been to Lambeau Field for a playoff game. I've been to Notre Dame for one of the famous Catholics versus Convicts games. I'm lucky. I've been, and obviously I've been all over the Southeast to the big games. What was going on at Sanford Stadium Saturday night was something I'd never experienced. And everyone I've talked to that was there agrees with me 100%. The atmosphere is something that can't be replicated, I don't think, anywhere else. Possibly, in some World Cup soccer in countries like Brazil, maybe is the closest thing I could think that we could compare it to. But I've never been down there, so I don't know for sure. And I've also had people ask me when I'd be talking college football, specifically in the Northeast, in your places like your New Yorks and your Bostons and your Philadelphias, and they don't understand how we are such rabid college fans. And the question they've asked is, well, how do you spend all your energy and your efforts into a college team when you've got a pro team there and the colleges aren't the best players? They're a step below the NFL. And I say, unless you experience it, you just don't know. A game day on virtually any college campus is more energetic. The regalia is just 10 times more than anything you'll see at an NFL game anywhere. The NFL games they're professionals. Those guys are working, and everything looks scripted and everything looks rehearsed and everything is just perfect right down to the grass and the way the guys have to wear their socks and whatnot. And I say, you just have to experience it, and you have to have grown up in it. With me being from Athens, Georgia football has been a key part of my life, you know, all my life. And it's something that, and there are thousands of others that share my opinion all over the Southeast and up in the Midwest and out to Texas. And in some places out West, they feel the same way. But atmosphere there was incredible. You know, the thing that makes me the happiest, obviously we won the game. Had we lost, that would have really pissed me off. But I was there all day, or not all day, but I was there a good part of the day tailgating. I walked, I had about a, you know, I don't know, 3/4 mile walk or so to the stadium. And during the tailgating, during my walk to the stadium, during my time in the stadium and walking back, I never heard a negative interaction between Georgia fans and Notre Dame fans, our visitors from Indiana or wherever they may live. As I mentioned last week, Notre Dame has a very national fan base. They may have, you know, who knows where they came from, but everybody seemed to have a great time. Everybody was really pleasant to each other. And that's something that makes me happy because, again, a lot of times at big games, people forget that you're not playing, boss. Okay? Like you talking trash to somebody that's walking down the street or walking by, you know, your tailgate or whatever the case may be, you're not playing. They're not playing. Just drink your beer, cheer for your team, and shut your mouth. And I didn't hear anything negative. And for the few Irish Pitt fans that I did talk to, we were tailgating beside a few, had a great time. They were treated lovely. That doesn't sound right. They were treated wonderfully. And as the Georgia fans were when they went to South Bend a few years ago. So really just fabulous effort by everybody involved, Georgia fans, the administration, everybody that had something to do with producing the event at Sanford Stadium. Great job. The light show, what can you say about the light show? That just set everything off. It was like being in an EDM show with 95,000 people jacked up on adrenaline. Really added a lot to the game day experience. I think that Georgia should now play every game at night. And when TV wants to play a game earlier, I think Georgia should just take less, whatever they need to do, take less money from their TV deal, but and make the game be 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whatever the case may be. Into the actual game itself, we kind of touched on it a little bit. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of it. Notre Dame came out with a very, very good game plan. They knew what Georgia being out, one cornerback, Tyson Campbell, and losing Eric Stokes, the other starting cornerback, a couple of plays into the game, kind of put the Bulldogs behind the eight ball very early because Notre Dame has, then they had a decided physical advantage at the wide receiver position, particularly with Chase Claypool, their number one receiver. I think he had 50 catches last year. He's 6'5", 230 pounds, and can move. Creates a big mismatch against guys like 5'10", Tyreek Stevenson, 6', DJ Daniel. And he caught 6 balls for 66 yards. That's a bad number, right? And was troubling to Georgia. I think he scored their touchdown. And when he would go out, when Book would look for him, it was unsettling because, you know, he's so big. He has such an advantage over those guys. It was worrisome. And I know I'm not alone when during the game I'm going, where did this number 84 come from? Who is this guy? Cole Kmet, y'all. Cole Kmet all of a sudden decided that Gronkowski had not retired, that Gronkowski was in fact playing for Notre Dame. And what allowed Cole Kmet to get open and become such a factor in the game? You know, this was his first game this year. Kirby and crew really had no reason to find him on film and to plan for him because, again, he was injured. He was out the first two games. Well, last year, when he did play more, he only had 15 catches. Didn't seem like somebody that you should really specially say, okay, we got to account for him every play. to Brian Kelly and the offensive staff at Notre Dame's credit, they did put him into the game plan. They saw weaknesses in that Georgia linebacking core and in Georgia's defensive scheme, and they took advantage of it. He caught 9 balls for over 100 yards, and he was Notre Dame's offense. You know, the Georgia defensive front held the Irish rush game in check. Tony Jones only had 21 yards. Really talented back. Ian Book only had 18 yards rushing with a long of 9. And that, and, you know, but on the flip side of that, Georgia couldn't get pressure on the quarterback. Now, I think that, and I'm not privy to the defensive plan, but I think that after watching the game again, I was there live, so you miss a lot of things live. You go back and watch. I think that the Georgia defensive plan was to keep Book in the pocket and to force him to beat you with his arm down the field. Because Georgia, they didn't do a lot of twist. They didn't do a lot of blitzing. They seemed to want to rush up the field and keep Book stationary, keep him standing there and force him to beat them with his arm. The only play that they got any real pressure on him was the very last play of the game. That was when Nolan Smith whipped his guy around the edge. Jermaine Johnson whipped his guy inside. They got after Book and forced him to make, just a desperate throw. Luckily, Georgia was able to knock the ball down. But that was the only play they were able to get pressure on him all night. Neither team recorded a sack. Not surprising for the Georgia offensive line. We knew coming into the game the Georgia offensive line was the best in the country. But I will give the Irish defensive front credit here. You know, Georgia did not run the ball as easily as we thought they would. DeAndre Swift ran for 98 yards. He got a lot of that after contact on his own with just incredible individual effort and athleticism. And Brian Herrien was held to, Georgia ran for 150 yards. Brian Herrien ended up running for most of the 50-ish yards or so. But the Georgia offensive line attack did not dominate the way we thought they would. I think later in the game, again, at the aforementioned 10-minute mark, when Georgia went into the stall game, Notre Dame was ready to break. And I think had Georgia kept their foot on the gas, then that line would have started to dominate. And inexplicably, again, Kirby and crew took their foot off the gas. Still not quite sure what the thought process were being up 10 points with 10 minutes to go and losing your top two cornerbacks and having mismatches. Not a comfortable position to be in. So we'll see if Kirby said after the game that we had stuff to work on, that the players had stuff to clean up and work on, and you can put the coaching staff in that group as well. They have something to work on as well. Hopefully, this is just another step and another in the maturation of Kirby Smart as a head coach and as a clock manager, per se. Cause I think, Notre Dame had the ball on the 38-yard line, down 6 points with 2 receivers out there that were over 6'5". You remember the Tennessee game in 16? Yeah. Okay. So that was not the position we deserved to be in after that game. Georgia won all aspects of the game pretty dominantly, but still Tennessee's 38 yards. Notre Dame is 38 yards away from winning the ball game. Good win by the Dogs. Again, there's a lot to clean up, and I think they will. Irish have nothing to hold their heads at. I think they have a very solid team. Brian Kelly is a great coach, great recruiter. They will be a player on the national stage forever. They will still have to prove that in the playoffs that they can beat the big dogs. And that's the next step for Notre Dame. Can they beat the big dogs? I tell you who cannot beat the big dogs. And that is Dan Quinn and the Atlanta Falcons. I cannot tell you the level of disappointment in watching the Falcons go to Indianapolis and lose to a backup quarterback. Jacoby Brissett's a solid player, but he's still a backup quarterback. You have to beat backup quarterbacks in this league. You just have to, especially if you have aspirations of winning the division and running deep in the playoffs like the Falcons do. The Falcons go to Indianapolis after a big win at home against Philly. They have some momentum. They righted the ship from that debacle in Minnesota week one. And the Falcons go to Indianapolis this past week and commit 16 penalties. 16 penalties for 128 yards. Guys, this is an NFL team. This is a professional team. All these people do is play football and practice football and prepare for football. You wake up in the morning, you shower, you go to your job. You work there all day. You come home, you get on your laptop, and you finish doing your job, because that's what corporate America has become now, right? You don't. The 8-hour work days are long gone. Same thing with the Atlanta Falcons. They get up, they go to the facility, they do their workouts, they do their practice, they do their walkthrough, they study, they go to their classroom, they're constantly working at football. That is their job. When you commit 16 penalties, the level of incompetence that takes is off the charts. Somebody needs to be fired here, okay? Now, I don't want to hear that it's a mistake. People make mistakes. If a 9-year-old jumps offside, we didn't have 16 penalties in our game Saturday. Sharon Springs, fourth grade, Falcons, 20 Falcons. We did not have 16 penalties then. Credit to Coach Mark. Credit to Coach Ben and crew. Coach Andy, Coach Chad, Coach Greg, Coach Dars. Coach Bagman, what's up, y'all? We didn't have 16 penalties, okay? How does an NFL team that gets paid a lot of money have 16 penalties? It's lack of discipline. You know where the lack of discipline comes from? Lack of respect for authority. Lack of respect for authority tells you that the message that Dan Quinn is spewing is not getting through anymore. The slick sales talk, the boiler room sales tactics, the cheesy one-liners, the cliches that has been what Dan Quinn is has lost its effectiveness. Talk about corporate America. Let's think about this. How many of you are in a some sort of a sales or performance position, and you show up at work on a Monday morning and you have the team meeting? God, we all have team meetings, right? Ugh. And in said team meeting, your boss has brought in a productivity coach, or, you know, basically a rah-rah guy, okay? And he comes in there and he stands in front of you and he pulls out his little cheesy one-liners and his motivational jargon. And how many times, guys, is this guy doing this? How many times is the productivity coach or the consultant or whatever somebody that was fired from your industry because he couldn't do the job? So he's turned into a motivational speaker. Yeah, okay. But regardless, you get pumped up initially. You're like, yeah, this is great. I'm going to use these sayings every day, and I'm going to listen to this cheesy stuff, and it's going to work for me. But then he comes in the next day, and he does the same thing. And then a month later, he's doing the same thing. And you, as an adult, as somebody that has to live an even-keel life, you can't get too high, you can't get too low. You have to live a nice, even-keel life. You've got a lot going on. So finally, you're like, dude, just chill. Just leave me. Just go. Go away. Leave me alone. That's where the Falcons are. That's where the Falcons have been with Dan Quinn. He first got there. He energized the program. People somewhat bought in. They were talking about the brotherhood and whatnot. They go to the Super Bowl. Should have won the Super Bowl. That's another conversation. But now it's... Dan Quinn's message is just lost. These guys are million. Everybody on that team, you've got 53 millionaires that all think that they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. They've got teams of people around them. They've got an entourage. They've got, you know, agents and managers and lawyers and business managers. And then they've got, you know, their personal trainer and their nutritionist. They got a team of people constantly telling them how good they are. So somebody like Dan Quinn showing up every day and trying to talk like that and trying to pump up a 20-year-old sales staff, it's not happening, guys. The message is lost. The fact that you had 16 penalties, the fact that you laid an egg in Indy, the fact that the defense gave up 27 points that could have been more because Indy sat on the ball at the end of the game. They could have had 30-plus. And again, Dan Quinn's a defensive guy. The message is lost. It's time for a change. I don't anticipate Arthur Blank making a change. Arthur Blank's MO is that he waits a year too long before he makes a change. We'll see how that ends up. But, you know, look at what he did with his GMs. He had, you know, Rich McKay couldn't be a GM, so he promoted him to team president. You know, he hires Thomas Dimitroff. Dimitroff's drafts are an absolute disaster. He hires somebody else to be the co-GM and you know, moves Thomas up to another GM. The Falcons have three GMs running around the office. I mean, who's in control? Now I hear that Dan Quinn is the one making the personnel moves. So why do we have three GMs and a head coach making the personnel moves? I mean, can't we have one GM figure out how many Cokes they need to buy to sell at the next game? Speaking of backup quarterbacks, y'all, talk a little NFC South action. I know we have some Panthers and Bucks and Saints fans out there. New Orleans Saints, Carolina Panthers go on the road, win ball games with a backup quarterback. Falcons could not beat a backup quarterback with their starting quarterback. Tampa Bay loses a tough one to get to the Giants with, guess what? Backup quarterback. Probably be the starter moving forward. But Daniel Jones got off, man. Daniel Jones got off. I mean, a lot of people gave the Giants a lot of crap for drafting him sixth overall. But wow, really? Two passing scores, two rushing scores, 300 yards plus passing and a win on the road? Huh. What a start, right? New Orleans going out to Seattle. That crowd, the 12th man, whatever. And credit to it, that's a real coach out there, y'all. Sean Payton is a real coach. That's what real coaches do. You know, your starter's out. You tweak your game plan. You do what you got to do to go get a win. And they went out there and got the win. Carolina Panthers, I said last week Cam Newton is over. I thoroughly believe that. I think he's done. I don't think he can throw the football anymore. He can't run the football. And when you're Cam Newton and you can't run, then you can't play because your arm has never been the reason you've been in the NFL. Kyle Allen for the Panthers is a much better option. I think he will be their starter the rest of the year. If he can consistently win games in the NFL, I don't know. But I look for him to be their starter moving forward. The Falcons had the door wide open to make a run. They appear that they are not interested. They appear that to me that they're ready to get going and get into the offseason so they can go back to Vegas and party and, you know, get on the radio and talk about what they're going to do. It's a gut check time for the Falcons, y'all. This is something that if the Falcon players and Matt Ryan and Julio and the leaders of this team are going to have to get together and win in spite of Dan Quinn, in spite of Dirk Koetter, the offensive coordinator. Which, by the way, how do we fire Dirk Koetter and then bring him back? I don't know. That would never happen in corporate America. You wouldn't fire somebody because he couldn't get the job done and then bring him back to the same position. This doesn't happen. But I tell you what does happen, and I would encourage you to join me, and that's enjoying a nice spirit, Pickers Vodka, if you're a white liquor guy, or Davidson's Reserve, Tennessee Whiskey, if you are a bourbon whiskey guy. Both of those products are top-notch. They are what I choose, and I have other choices. They are my sponsor, and I appreciate them greatly for that, and I would encourage you to support them. As you all know, I am a champion of small business. Support small business. It is the backbone of America. Small businesses are the ones that buy the ads in our Little League programs and support our kids and our kids' programs. They buy the popcorn for the popcorn drive and things like that. You know, without small business, guys, we become a socialist country. That's a fact. America is the greatest country in the world because we allow small business to grow and thrive. Everything that we see now, be it Apple, Microsoft, whatever the company may be, Amazon, Walmart, all started out as small business. So guys, I'm gonna get out of here. Stamp of Approval episode 2. Again, I thoroughly appreciate each and every one of you. I appreciate your support. I talked to B-Hyphen earlier, or yesterday actually, and he gave me the numbers for episode 1, and I'm blown away at the support. I'm incredibly humbled by it, and I appreciate it more than you'll ever know. So I hope you have a great day. I hope your families are well. I hope everything goes well in your life. And I'm looking forward to coming back with episode 3 a little later on this week. We'll preview some of the games going on this week in college and pro football. And we'll continue to grow and to build this thing and have a good time. So until then, everybody be safe. I appreciate each and every one of you, and catch up with you on episode 3 of the Stamp of Approval. I'm out. Many a day has passed, the night has gone by, but still I find the time to put